Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Mid-Major Madness podcast. Along with Chris Schutte, I am Russ Steinberg. Our other editor, Greg Mitchell, is off on assignment tonight. By that, we mean I think he's driving home from Oklahoma City, where he was at a Thunder game. So it's just going to be the two of us today, but we still have a bit to get to after, I don't know, about 10 days or so since our last podcast. So, Chris, let's dive right into it. I know usually up top we just kind of like to go around and talk about a game or a team that's really impressed us over the last week, but I think both of us had wanted to talk about UNLV. They did lose two games this week, but to two really good teams at Northern Iowa and home against Arizona. We both watched that Arizona game last night, and the Rebels have some pretty good pieces here, don't they?
Yeah, that's putting it as an understatement. I think that going into the year, everybody kind of felt like UNLV was going to be a team that took a step forward and was going to be probably a middle-of-the-pack Mountain West team. But early on, they've shown that they've got some high-level players. They're big, they're athletic, and they've shown it early on to start the season. They're 6-2, like you said. Only losses are to Northern Iowa and Arizona, both in OT this week, which by no means are bad losses, but they've been a pleasant surprise, and frankly, they've been one of the most entertaining teams to watch so far this year.
Yeah, and I think any conversation you have about them starts with their freshman, Brandon McCoy, who's been a consistent kind of 20-10 guy, even more than that, really, to start. I've loved watching him go toe-to-toe with DeAndre Ayton. Ayton was a little bit better, but McCoy held his own pretty much all game, and he's one of those guys who, if you just know that McCoy's their best player and know nothing else about him or about UNLV, if you watch him play for like 2 seconds, you instantly know who McCoy is on the court. Like, he's that much of a presence, that much of a difference maker, but someone who I had not really seen play just because I don't get to watch him out in West all that often, and UNLV before this year hadn't been terribly relevant, is Shakur Justin, averaging 14-12 per game, and is just another large adult son on this UNLV team. Am I wrong?
You're not. I think I was writing about them for Stockwatch a week or two ago, and he was one guy that jumped out at me just based off of his counting stats. I think at the time he was, I think, pulling down 13 rebounds a game. And like you said, he's another guy he's big, and he provides a nice complement to McCoy. And that's one of the reasons that they've been so good. They've got two of the best rebounders in the conference. And when you have two guys of that kind of size and athleticism, there aren't going to be many teams that they can match up with them.
Yeah. And Justin is the JUCO transfer, right?
Yeah, I believe he was JUCO Player of the Year last year. I couldn't tell you where he's from, but he's obviously a talented player.
Yeah, and I guess with that front court, and UNLV is going to be a tough team to match up with in the Mountain West, and I think the Mountain West as a whole is going to be a lot of fun this year. We said at the beginning we're not exactly sure how many bids the Mountain West gets if they are a multi-bid league this year, but it definitely looks like they have a handful of teams that could get into the tournament. Talking about UNLV, I think they're one of them. Nevada right now is one of the best mid-major teams in the country, maybe the best. Boise State has some really good wins. They also have a really good guy on their team. The Mountain West's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I would say there's probably four or five teams that would not surprise me to get the bid from that conference. Like you said, Nevada, Boise State, UNLV, but San Diego State's off to a nice start, 6-2. They've got a win over Georgia. I think they're playing Bradley tonight for the last game of the challenge with the Missouri Valley. And then Fresno State 6-2. They've got a couple good guards in Deshaun Taylor and Jerron Hopkins that can, if they get it going on a certain night, they can be a tough out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. San Diego State's another team that I've watched a couple of times and is better than I expected them to be. So it's going to be a really fun conference. And also, I don't want to take away at all. We're talking about the large adult sons of UNLV. I don't want to take away from Jordan Johnson, their 5'11 guard transfer from Milwaukee, who's also off to a really nice start this year.
Yeah, he's electric, and I think he's the one that kind of sets the table for the team, just because he's all gas, no brakes. I think even one of the announcers for the game last night commented on that he's going 100 miles per hour at all times, and sometimes that can bite you in the butt if you get going a little bit too fast and out of control. But I mean, other teams have to match up with his tempo, and for a lot of teams, that's hard to adjust to.
Yeah, just looking at his numbers, he does have, looks like, 4 games with 5 or more turnovers, which probably not what you want, but he also has a few double-digit assist games. He has a few 20-point games. Like, he can fill it up. So
yeah, and I think that another guy that has been good for them so far has been Javon Mooring, just kind of been that steady presence. He's had double digits in 7 of their 8 games, and he's shooting. He's not shooting the ball too well from 3, but he's a guy that's capable of getting hot. He hit 5 of 8 from downtown in their first game, and he's had a couple other games where he's knocked in a couple of shots. So I think that with those two guys in the backcourt and the 2 large adult sons down low, UNLV is going to be a team to keep an eye on.
Yeah, so UNLV probably going to smack Oral Roberts on Tuesday, but after that they get interesting game, a neutral court game, I believe, against Illinois. That'll be one to watch, and then they're not really tested again until conference play. We could be looking at a team here going into New Year's, or going into the end of December at least, that's, you know, maybe 10 or 11-2, and maybe even getting some top 25 consideration, because they've been playing that well. And again, they're only 2 losses in overtime, one of them to Arizona. And I know Arizona faltered in Atlantis, but they're still one of the most talented teams in the country. And then at a Northern Iowa team that I think we all have learned is a lot better than last year's Northern Iowa team, and maybe better than we even expected them to be.
Yeah, and I'm looking at their KenPom page right now, and he doesn't project them losing until January 23rd at Fresno State. So he has them winning out in non-conference play, and then opening Mountain West play with, 6 straight wins. So they open with Boise State. They get that at home. They have road games against San Jose State and Air Force, which are probably the 2 worst teams in the Mountain West, and then winnable home games against Utah State and Colorado State. So, I mean, if they went out in non-conference play and get off to a good start, I mean, that's the kind of track record that can build momentum and carry you towards the end of the season.
Yeah. Sorry. While we're on the topic, shout out to Boise State for that amazing half-court shot to win it at Oregon. Lexus Williams hit that one over the weekend. Felt we needed to mention that. Oregon, maybe not as good as they are in most years, but Mountain West has asserted itself as a really strong league this year, and Boise's definitely a part of that. So while we're talking about the Mountain West and UNLV and Houston and McCoy, it makes for a pretty good segue into something that you're working on, something that might have a lot to do with the McCoys or the Chandler Hutchisons of the world. And I'm not sure I could really set it up properly, because you've done hours and hours of work on this. So why don't you take it away, and we're going to discuss this little project of yours for a bit.
All right. So this project, I don't have a good name for it, which is a shame, but it's essentially the, I call it the guys versus the dudes theory, which sounds very weird at face value, but the gist of it is that to be a really good team, and for the data sample that I've been using championship teams and Final Four teams, you need to have at least either one dude who is going to be a guy that can really take it to the next level and can really be like the, like a superstar for your team. So a good example of quote unquote dudes would be Kemba Walker, Carmelo Anthony, Juan Dixon, Tyler Hansbrough, those guys that you know are going to be there when you need them to get a bucket and are capable of carrying you to, in this example, a national title. Now, where the guys come in, and those are going to be those players that are really good, they're really nice pieces, but can't quite hit that extra tier. And so the general idea is that you need either a dude and some assortment of guys, or three or four quote-unquote guys. And there's no real like scientific term for how to classify them. It's just something that I've seen on Twitter, people saying X team has dudes or X team has a lot of guys. And it just made me think, all right, what's really the difference between the two? And so that's the basic idea of it. I'm not sure how to really explain it without really like sitting down and putting it into writing and getting the set definitions of each criteria. I'm still working through that part.
So did this come from seeing tweets like so-and-so is a dude or something, or this team has dudes?
Yeah, okay. I think, and this is something that I've even talked about with my friends, related to the NBA. You know, you're sitting around at a bar and you're talking to your friends about whatever team. So the big thing with the NBA, most likely the Pacers, the general thinking in the NBA is that you need probably two or three of the best players in the league. Essentially, you need dudes, and you can't win a championship with a bunch of guys, hence why the Warriors and Cavs are winning the title every year. And it just kind of made me think about, okay, can I take this down to a smaller scale on college basketball? And I've been using Ken Pom's pages, and he breaks them into tiers for players. He's got go-to guys, major contributors, significant contributors, and role players, which he bases it off of the percentage of possessions used. So that was kind of the starting point. And as I got into the numbers, I started to realize that most of the quote unquote guys are going to be those high usage guys that are scoring a lot and taking up a large chunk of their team's offense.
Okay. So like even in the last few days when we've been discussing this, we've had, you know, look, like you said, it's not an exact science to define a dude versus a guy, and it's something where you sort of know it when you see it. There are the numbers that you talked about that could be a pretty good guideline for you, but like you knew watching Kemba Walker play in that NCAA tournament that he was a dude. You knew it by watching. Like same thing with Juan Dixon and Carmelo. So what I thought we would do now, if there's anyone listening who maybe isn't entirely sure of what makes a dude versus what makes a guy, that I would throw you a few names of mid-major basketball players this year, and you would tell me if they are guys, dudes, or neither. That sound good?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. First one from UT Arlington. I'll give you the duo of Eric Neal and Kevin Hervey.
Okay. I would say they have one of each. For the dude, I would consider Kevin Hervey to be the dude. He's their go-to guy. He's their leading scorer, averaging 23 points a game. I've got his KenPom page up. He's taken about 35% of his team's shots when he's on the floor, so he's obviously going to be the one they're looking to run their offense through. As far as Eric Neal goes, I would consider him to be the guy just because he's more of a facilitator and he doesn't necessarily look to be a scorer first. And I think that's part of why his assist numbers are so high. So I think UT Arlington is one of the rare teams, especially mid-major teams in the country that have one of each.
All right. And then I'll give you another duo, Caleb Martin, Jordan Caroline from Nevada.
See, those two are tricky because on any given night, either one of them can be the go-to guy per se. And they're two different type of players. Caleb Martin's a long athletic wing, a little more perimeter oriented. Jordan Caroline's this large, muscular, athletic kind of combo forward that can really hurt you on the glass and the inside, but can also step out and knock down threes. So I'm not sure if I would put either of them into either category. It just kind of depends on a given night. If I had to pick one, I would probably say Caroline is the dude just because I think he takes on a little bit heavier workload. But I have no problem with saying the same for Caleb Martin.
Well, then I'll ask, is it possible to be a dude one night and then fill the guy role in the next? Or is it that once you're a dude, you're a dude?
It's certainly possible. The science doesn't like to pigeonhole people into one specific role. But I think, especially early on in the season, it's kind of hard to project, but over the course of the season, it's usually going to play out and you can determine who's going to be the one that you really look to when you need him.
Okay. Well, I think this one is going to be a little bit easier for you. So give me the guys and the dudes of St. Mary's. And, you know, we're talking Jack Landale, Emmett Nair, Caleb Hermanson, anyone else you want. I mean, despite those early losses, they are loaded with talent.
Yeah, they're another team that just has a lot of really talented players. I would probably consider Jack Landale to be a dude just because, I mean, there aren't that many players like him in college basketball that can get buckets like he can on the low block. Emmett Nair, kind of similar to Eric Neal in the sense that he's not necessarily a score-first guy. He's more of a facilitator. And then Calvin Hermanson, I would also consider to be a guy just because he's kind of that third banana. He gets a lot of his offense off of spot-up shots and cuts. And then I'm not sure if there's anybody else I would put him in there. Maybe you could call Colin Neal a guy if he gets some of his scoring figured out and gets into a rhythm, but out of those main three, I would say Jack Landale can be considered a dude, and then Nair and Hermanson can be considered guys.
All right, going across the country, Peyton Aldridge.
Oh, he's a dude. He has one purpose on the floor, and it's to get buckets. And he's obviously the focal point of Davidson's offense, and he's taken a pretty substantial percentage of their shots.
So I guess you could probably say the same for Chris Clemens at Campbell then.
Absolutely. And it's always hard to determine the difference between if he's a dude or if he's just a guy that's a gunner.
Right. Right.
Which is, in Clemens' case, I think he's kind of a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen him light it up, but he's also somebody that's you aren't surprised if he kind of shoots a team out of a game. So there's a dangerous responsibility that comes with being a guy like Clem, is that pretty much has the ultimate green light.
All right. Well, I will say Marcus Burke actually outscored him in their last game. And Burke, I think, is quickly falling into the dude category as well. Just as a sophomore, but he's putting up 20 a game and shooting 53% from three. So he's not just a gunner.
That's efficiency.
Yeah. All right. Then this one may be a little bit tougher. Justin Tillman.
He would be a guy. I just don't think he has that extra gear. VCU's always, they've been a team that traditionally, I think, doesn't have that one piece that has that extra gear. They've always been a team that kind of, has six or seven really good players that can step up on a given night. That was kind of the same thing with Wichita State. I know that was one of the teams I was looking at in the Final Four spreadsheet. They had five or six different players that were really big contributors, but none of them really were a cut above the others.
Gotcha. I wanted to throw Killian Tilly into this conversation too, because he's not, but by his statistics and by the way he has played so far in his Gonzaga career, he is not a dude, but he strikes me as someone who is a solid guy with maybe in the future some dude-like tendencies.
Yeah, that's probably how I would phrase it. He's shown the flashes of being able to be somebody that you can run an offense through and on a certain night can just be unstoppable for an opposing team. And Gonzaga is another one of those teams that kind of falls into the, we have so many talented players. It's hard for, one of our main pieces to really be a cut above the others, unless you're talking about like Adam Morrison, who is,
right,
very clearly a dude. But yeah, Tilly, I think if he doesn't make the jump to the NBA, possibly next year could be a monster year for him.
All right, last one for you. Anthony Lamb of Vermont.
Ooh, that's, I forgot to look up his
information. See, I didn't go with Trey Bell Haynes, who I guess would be the go-to on that team. I don't even know what the, I don't even know if he's the leading scorer, but I assume so. But Anthony Lamb, who was one of the most exciting freshmen in the mid-major world last year, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on him once you get his numbers pulled up.
All right. Okay. He's taking over 30% of Vermont's shots when he's on the floor, which I consider to be kind of a clear-cut sign that he's your main main point of offense. The hard thing with a team like Vermont is that their pace obviously is going to warp the counting numbers a little bit. He's only averaging 15 a game, which isn't quite in the territory of, say, a Peyton Aldridge or a Jock Landale. But I think, at least on the level of the America East, he's absolutely a dude on the scale of national players, maybe not quite at that level.
Gotcha. Those are the only ones that I had. I know you're going to write this up and get it on the site. Do you think you're going to share the whole spreadsheet madness, or do you think people will actually like commit you to a mental institution if you shared that thing?
If people want to see it, by all means, I will share.
How long did that take you?
I don't know, it's probably 8 or 9 hours on and off at various points. It was kind of fun to go through and look at all these, all of the teams from quote unquote the KenPom era, and just kind of reminisce on some of these old teams and old players they had kind of forgotten about.
So Juan Dixon was the dude on that team. I assume Steve Blake was the guy.
I don't even know if I want to give Steve Blake that much credit.
I hate him so much.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, Juan Dixon, he would definitely be the guy. And something I noticed from doing this is that for every champion, there's either a clear-cut, like, superstar, or at least three or four really good players, which I think is an interesting bit of criteria.
We started off this whole thing with you saying in the NBA that you need to have at least one dude on your team.
Right.
Maybe it's not the case in college, or you need somebody who's going to play like a dude in the NCAA tournament, which we were looking at, like that 2010 Duke team. It doesn't have a quote unquote dude, but like Kyle Singler was one in the Final Four.
Yeah. So you get a team like Duke that has just three guys that are taking up 80% of the scoring. But then you have a team like 2016 Villanova, who's very balanced and they spread it out. Mm-hmm. Or a team like the 2012 Kentucky team with Anthony Davis and those guys. Anthony Davis, his offensive numbers don't show that he has the offensive numbers of a dude, but I haven't figured out a good way to quantify just how dominant he was on defense. So it's just interesting to see the different compositions of championship teams and those teams that have made Final Fours as well.
All right, well let's get away from the dudes for a minute, but I'm sure it's a topic we'll revisit a bunch of times, because between guys, dudes, and large adult sons, I think you're going to define every player in college basketball.
Yeah, I'm going to run out of masculine terms to generalize players with.
All right, so we both listen to the Eye on College Basketball podcast that Matt Norlander and Gary Parrish do, and they dropped one yesterday or the day before, and hidden within it was something that's not really talked about too much, but is pretty interesting. So I wanted to touch on it here. So shout to Norlander and Parrish and Devin Downey and Chester, South Carolina, and Terry MF and Teagle. They were talking about that Gonzaga Creighton game the other day, and it was a really good game. I don't think the final score is too indicative on really how competitive that game was, because didn't Gonzaga end up winning that by double digits?
Yeah, I'm pulling up the box score. They won by 17, but I don't think they really started to pull away until the later part of the second half.
Yeah, that was a good game, and that's part of a home-and-home between those two teams, which, first of all, great for both teams, great for college basketball, because those are two excellent programs, and it's great to see them playing each other. But Norlander was talking about this game, and he said that he has heard that one of the reasons this game or this series happened is because at Gonzaga they would really like to get into the Big East. Problem is right now they don't have the votes. I don't know what the vote breakdown would be. I've tried to think about kind of who would or wouldn't be on board with this. But it's something interesting to bring up, because the Big East is such a strong basketball conference. On the court, obviously, Gonzaga would fit in very well, but Gonzaga is also in Spokane, Washington, and it's the Big East. So it does bring up some challenges there, but I wanted to get your thoughts on this. Would it be a good move for Gonzaga if they could get the votes together? Would it be a good move for the Big East? Just kind of where you fall on that.
Yeah, that was something that I was surprised by, because the only time that I've ever really considered Gonzaga to be an expansion candidate would be to the Pac-12, which was something I think Norlander mentioned on the podcast. And it's weird to think about, just because of how, I don't know what the right term, traditional, would that be a good way to describe the Big East? I mean, these teams have been playing each other for God knows how long.
Well, a bunch of them have, and then there's Butler, Xavier, and Creighton.
Yeah, you have the Georgetowns, the Villanovas, those old Big East teams. And obviously the geography of it is going to be probably the headline. But in terms of basketball, obviously it makes the Big East better. But then you also think, why would Gonzaga leave? They've gotten their program to a certain point where they've almost become immune to the different pitfalls that have plagued mid-majors year in and year out. So granted, joining the Big East, more competitive league, probably more money. On the other hand, they have shown that year in and year out, they're going to own the West Coast Conference, they're going to be in the NCAA tournament, and they're going to have top-level talent. So that kind of begs the question, why leave if you've got it so good right now?
Right, and if it were to happen, the move would 100% be because of the men's basketball program, and it would be 100% for, or primarily, maybe not 100%, but primarily for the money that the Big East brings in, being probably a lot more than the West Coast Conference, and that number would go up even more if you bring in a brand like Gonzaga. As far as the geographic challenges go, I think that's a legitimate concern. But I also think that in some ways people oversell that a little bit.
Yeah.
And I say that not only from a basketball perspective, but looking at the other sports that Gonzaga sponsors. If you look at baseball, and mind you, I'm not entirely sure how the Big East does their Olympic sports schedules, but I can speak generally on how a lot of conferences do this. In baseball, you don't play at every single team every year. There are normally events held in one location where you'll get three or four teams from your conference, and then you'll play like a few home and a few road series in your league. Volleyball, it's the same sort of deal. Gonzaga does have men's and women's soccer, so that would probably be an issue. Golf, you don't travel to every single school. So I think it's a bit overstated there, and Norlander brought up on the podcast that, you know, Gonzaga already has to fly down the West Coast for so many of its conference games. Granted, that's a much shorter flight than, say, Spokane to New York. But, you know, it's still a significant chunk of time that's taken out of your day. It's still a significant chunk of money that costs. This would be a little more, sure, but I'm not sure it's so much more that it would be, it would make the extra money that you would bring in from being in the Big East not worth it. I think your concern, or the concern that you raised about how Gonzaga just owns the West Coast Conference right now, is probably more valid than people would think, because I think most people, their point of reference for conference expansion and the pros and cons are in the Power Five, where if you go from, you know, non-Power Five money to Power Five money, you're increasing what you take in by 7 or 8 times. Like, it's that much of a difference. So that if you run a smaller conference and you have an opportunity to go compete in the Power Five, like, you do it, because, you know, so you take a few more losses, you're bringing in so much more money, it doesn't matter. That's not the case going from, say, the West Coast Conference to the Big East. The Big East does well financially, but still not compared to, say, the Big Ten or the Pac-12. Obviously, you don't do this if you're Gonzaga, if you have reason to believe that the Pac-12 would ever be interested in bringing in a non-football member. Gonzaga does not have a football program. It's not even like they're competing at the FCS level and they can move up. They just don't have a football program. So if you think the Pac-12 would ever be interested in that, then I think you wait it out and you stay in the West Coast Conference. But if they are all in on trying to get into the Big East, it seems like that's probably an option that they've already explored.
Yeah, and going back to what you said about the money, Gonzaga's they're not on the level of a Duke or Kentucky in terms of a brand name level, but they're a huge name, especially for Nike. I mean, they got invited to PK80. They're playing next week, and are they playing at the Jimmy V? Is that the game against Villanova?
Yeah, that's the Jimmy V, Gonzaga, Villanova, another Big East school, and then Syracuse versus hopefully future Big East school UConn.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think money's going to be the deciding factor in the end. So that's something that I think is really interesting. And you make a good point about the travel. And I think that there could possibly be a way that if Gonzaga were to be brought into the mix, that whoever's making the schedule and all that kind of stuff, they could figure out a way to make it logistically feasible so that, you know, Gonzaga's not flying to Providence on a Tuesday night, getting back early Thursday morning and have to gear up for a game against Villanova Saturday afternoon. I think that there's a way that the programs could maybe figure it out so that, hey, we've got to travel to Gonzaga. It's our only game of the week. Maybe Gonzaga gets two home games in a row and then they head out east for two road games in a row. That way they're not, you know, flying cross country two times a week.
Right. And this might surprise you, but I have thought of a way that they could make this work a little bit better in terms of travel. And it does involve adding a 12th team.
Who might
that 12th team doesn't have to be any one program that is looking to change basketball conferences. But if it were an East Coast program, then you could expand the Big East to 12, divide it into East and West. And that way, every year, you're only sending Gonzaga to Marquette, Creighton, DePaul, Butler, Xavier. Not, you know, I guess even with Butler and Xavier, those aren't flights that are too much shorter, but it does save a little bit there. And then you host half of the teams in the East and fly to half of them, and that way you're saving some money on travel there. But again, you would need a 12th team to make that work. I'm just saying, if there's anybody else you could find in the Big East and you really want to increase the number of brand names you have in that conference and bring in another huge fan base and increase the value of your next TV deal, that might be a way to do it.
I don't know where you're getting this information from, but I don't think Syracuse is really looking to leave the ACC right now. I think they're in a pretty good situation, despite how poor their team might actually be.
Actually, I was talking about Louisville.
Oh well, so they're running out of the bag. They might need some money here soon.
Although they're getting a lot more in the ACC. Be real.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I don't think this is something that we're going to hear about a lot in the immediate future. These things tend to take a lot of time and they tend to happen behind closed doors. The thing I would be looking at is, I believe the Big East's TV contract is up in 2020, might be 2023 with the rest of them. I can't remember, but it's not for another few years. And that would be the time when I would expect, if the Big East is going to expand, it would do so, because that way it could get a lot more out of Fox or out of wherever they go, whether it's a TV package or a streaming package. It's hard to say at this point because we don't know what that sort of thing is going to look like 4 or 5 years down the road. But That would be when I would expect any movement, if there is any, and it doesn't necessarily mean there will be. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting wrinkle into watching how Gonzaga schedules. We talked about this in the Slack earlier today, that Gonzaga may be playing Villanova in Ireland next year. Just something to keep an eye on and something to fuel speculation from people like us and from people on the Twitters as well. Just a fun little thing there.
And I think, I don't know if it was you or somebody else that mentioned it, but I mean, if you can fly to Ireland, I think you can manage a trip to Seton Hall.
Yes, although Ireland is just once, and you know.
Yeah, but
yes, you're right. I think the last thing I wanted to touch on before we get out of here is Nevada, because they seem to be a program. Not only are they winning, but
they're killing people.
Yes, and people on a national scale have started to take notice, which is a nice little change for us. Looking at their resume now, they've beaten Rhode Island and Davidson, two strong mid-majors, also Illinois State. Go to their KenPom page. There is a lot of green there.
Yes.
they have two tests coming up at Texas Tech and on a neutral court against TCU. So we might learn a little more about them there, but you've seen Nevada play a few times. What do you think? Are they for real?
Yeah, they're 100% for real. I've come dangerously close to putting them first in my rankings. I think they're that good. Looking at their schedule, you mentioned the two tests against Texas Tech and TCU this week. Let's say they win those.
Mm-hmm.
What are the chances of Nevada being the last unbeaten in college basketball? What do you think?
Oh,
is that you remember that prediction thing I was trying to put together earlier?
Yep.
I think one of my predictions was a mid-major will be the last undefeated team, and I was mainly thinking St. Mary's.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you look at their schedule at Texas Tech, who, you know, good team, the top 20 KenPom team, TCU. I think they're ranked, but that's on a neutral court. After that, their non-conference is cake, a bunch of 100 level KenPom teams, and then they hit conference play. So is there a scenario that you could see Nevada being undefeated heading into February, for say?
Yeah, I mean, this all hinges on them beating a really good Texas Tech team and a really good TCU team away from home, which I don't think is going to happen. But if they do, their next real tough test would be at Fresno State on December 27th. And then after that, they don't have another one until almost February. So, yeah, if they're good enough to beat Texas Tech and TCU away from home, it's certainly a possibility. And if they win those two games, yes, I do think they are probably the last unbeaten team in college basketball.
That's
and also, if they win those two games, I'll rank them number one next week.
I will too. I was,
no matter what Gonzaga does.
Yeah, I've come dangerously close to doing it the last couple of things. I think there was someone else that did it last week. I don't remember who, but
oh, you know what? I lied, because Gonzaga's playing Villanova. So if they beat Villanova, I might keep them.
Well, apples to oranges. But yeah,
sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
I love this Nevada team. I think they're a lot of fun to watch, and I don't stay up for many West Coast games, but if I see that they're on, I usually try to catch a little bit of them. They're exciting to watch.
I still have not seen one of their games yet, and I'm getting very impatient, and I know I should. So I need to see. I assume at least one of those games.
Yeah,
this week is going to be on TV, so I'm going to have to watch them.
Yeah, I'm going to try to pull up the TV schedule.
It has to be.
Yeah. The only full game I've seen from theirs was the game against Rhode Island that started at like 11:30 and didn't get over till middle of the morning.
So that, okay, so the TCU game is on ESPNU.
Okay, perfect.
All right, at 1 a.m. Not as perfect.
Where, that's the neutral site game, right? Where's that?
Yeah, they're playing that in L.A.
They're playing at Staples?
Yeah, they do an event there every year.
So there's probably some, who else is playing there? St. John's and Arizona State before that. Yuck.
Well, Arizona State's not bad.
They're fun, but I mean, like, it's late. It's Friday.
The Texas Tech game is on Fox College Sports. It might end up being on, like, one of those weird extra channels that I get. I don't know. But I hope that's the case because I do not want to watch them play at 1 a.m.
Texas Tech is fun, too. They've got some athletic players on their team. I watched a little bit of them earlier this week, I think, against Seton Hall.
Oh, wait, I won't be watching the Texas Tech game either because I'll be at the Jimmy V.
You're the worst.
No, I'm not because it's going to be a lot of fun, even though
who else is
the team I'm rooting for is going to lose.
Is UConn, Syracuse is the other game, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's always fun. Like, yeah. No matter who ends up winning that game, it's fun. I'll also have many beverages beforehand.
Don't forget to call the cops.
I won't forget to call the cops, and I will definitely be in our Slack updating you on the number of beverages I have.
I wouldn't expect anything less.
All right. Do you have trivia?
I don't. I completely spit. Let me see if I can find something. All right. I got one. Do you have the spreadsheet open?
The dude spreadsheet?
Yeah.
Yes.
Close it.
Okay. It is closed.
All right. What is the... This is such a bad question. What is the lowest ranked KenPom team that's won the national title since 2002 in the KenPom area? What school? What rank?
2014.
Yes.
The University of Connecticut.
Absolutely.
And I think they ended up finishing like seventh.
No, they were 15th.
15th.
They were actually...
Oh, right. Yes.
They had the 39th ranked offense, which is the lowest of any champion, and then 10th ranked defense. So there you have it.
I think they were seventh or somewhere around there, and then KenPom changed its formula.
Probably.
And they got bumped a lot. But because I'm the UConn fan on this site, I need to defend that team because I know they weren't the best champion, obviously, but they were the best that year when they needed to be. They beat a 1, 2, 3, and 4 seed on their way to that title.
Because they had a dude.
So what?
Because they had a dude.
They had a dude. They had Shabazz and they had some good guys too.
Absolutely.
You know, you could whine about how they were the worst champion in the KenPom era, but they beat Michigan State, a team that a lot of people picked to win it all. They beat Florida in the Final Four, a team that a lot of people picked to win it all. They beat Villanova in the second round, a team that loses in the second round a lot. And they beat a Kentucky team in the championship game that even though they were an 8 seed...
Had an absurd amount of talent.
They were not... Yeah. They had an absurd amount of talent, and they were not playing like an 8 seed in that tournament.
Yeah, they beat that was the year that they beat Wichita and ruined the undefeated season, right?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
And that was,
so that's all I have to say about that.
That was, we've probably hit an all-time record for UConn talk on this podcast.
And we haven't even mentioned how they're absolute trash this year.
Hey, they got two big wins this week.
You know what? You can make fun of that all you want. I will take close wins over mid-majors over losses to mid-majors any day of the week.
Hey, at least your team's winning games.
Yeah. Give me all of the 4-point wins over Columbia or whatever it was. That's fine by me. That's actually not true. Please fire Kevin Ollie and hire Dan Hurley.
Hire Tom Crean.
Or Tom Crean. Or really my top pick would be Steve Peichel. But we could have that discussion later. All right.
Let's get out of here.
Yeah, let's get out of here. You don't have anything else to add, do you?
Quick shout out to St. Bonaventure. They just got Jalen Adams back. Yeah. Currently ranked 69th in KenPom.
Okay.
And that's it. That's all I have.
That's okay. It's like is there any significance to that number or anything?
There's not.
Just a note. Okay. Nice. All right. Let's get out of here then. Thank you everybody for listening to the Mid-Major Bandits podcast. For Chris Schutte, I am Russ Steinberg. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you again, I don't know, probably in about a week if we feel like talking to you. Have a good one.